The New York Times has called Stacy Keach America's finest classical actor. He's also one of our most versatile. In over 187 films, numerous TV shows, and countless stage performances, he's played just about everything. Private Eyes, a professional boxer, Richard Nixon, and more than one Shakespearean king. And he's written a memoir about his remarkable career called All in All, An Actor's Life on and Off the Stage. It's published by Lions Press. I'm very pleased it has brought Stacy Keach to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Lynn. Nice to be here.
You're also in Alexander Payne's new film, Nebraska, which is opening this week, and
right.
In Disney's Planes. This must be a very busy time for you.
It is a very – I'm blessed because I love to work, and I haven't been busier. This has been a great year for me. I have two kids who are in college, so I have to keep punching the clock.
And you also have the book coming out. So.
That's right. The book is just coming out.
In Nebraska, you play a not very nice former associate, Bruce Dern's character.
Right.
Do you like playing bad boy roles?
I love playing bad boy roles. Yeah. I think you have much more freedom, emotional and behavioral freedom as an actor when you're playing the bad guy, because there's no such thing as being politically correct.
Well, you've played Hamlet, Macbeth, and King Lear, and that seems to cover a full range of mental states.
That's true. That's true. Absolutely.
Was your father in show business?
He was. My dad was an actor, director, producer. And in fact, he introduced me to this business through radio. He did a show called Tales of the Texas Rangers for NBC with Joel McRae. It was on Sunday nights. And I remember in the 50s, I was 12 years old, going down to Hollywood and Vine, the NBC studios, and watching him direct Joel McRae and Willard Waterman, Bill Conrad, all of these wonderful actors of that day.
Willard Waterman of our Miss Brooks fame?
The Great Gildersleeve.
Oh, Great Gildersleeve,
yeah,
right.
Yeah,
yeah. You were in one of those families where you knew a lot of celebrities and were unaware, I'm assuming, of just how famous they were outside?
Well, yeah, to a certain extent, yes. I lived in a neighborhood where there were a lot of famous people living around. Lou Costello.
I envy you that.
John Wayne, who we used to Christmas carol at his house when we were young. And, it was great.
Is that why you decided to become an actor?
I didn't know what else I wanted to do. I mean, it was either that or music. And I stayed with my music all my life. But acting, I think, was the thing that I started when I was in junior high school and in school plays. And it was the thing that stuck with me more than
And you. You mentioned music. You write that while you were at Berkeley, you wrote songs for musical reviews.
Uh-huh. I still compose. I still write music.
Do you sing as well?
I'm not a singer. I mean, I can talk, sing, you know, but I'm not a singer. I don't have any pretensions in that regard. But I am, and I've done musicals. I did Barnum, I did The King and I did Camelot. I've done sort of those talk singing roles.
And you're writing songs?
Yeah.
What happens to those songs?
Well, one song is on a show that I narrate called American Greed on CNBC, and it's called Anything for Money, because the slogan for that show is some people will do anything for money. So I wrote a song in blues. I play piano and keyboard.
Were your parents happy when you decided you wanted to go into show business?
Initially, no. In fact, they were absolutely dismayed. I mean, my father said, no, we want you to be a doctor or a lawyer. And when I went from high school to college, the edict was you must get certain grades. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to go and audition for the school play. Well, I managed to get through my freshman year barely at Berkeley. And then I got a chance to audition for a play. And that was it. I knew... At that point, that's what I wanted to do.
Is college a good place to learn how to act? Because you point out that no one at Berkeley, Yale, or Lambda taught you how to deal with rejection as an actor.
Oh, well, that's the one thing they don't teach you, no. I don't think they teach you. I mean, even if I'd taken psychology, maybe so, or behavioral sociology, I don't know. But no, rejection is something that I think that, nobody... I mean, how do you deal with rejection? It's a very difficult thing. I mean, you have to be, you have to let your emotions happen. You're just the disappointment and not getting the part that you wanted, and move on. And it's easier said than done. That's for sure.
Well,
you need a support. You need a support mechanism. You need friends and family, I think, to help you through.
Because
that.
It can happen again and again. Exactly. But at a certain point in your life, I guess, you become famous enough so that you don't have to audition anymore.
Well, yes and no. I mean, even today, I still have to. If people want to find out how your ethos, your makeup works with somebody else, that's understandable. I mean, if you take Peter O'Toole and Anthony Hopkins and Michael Gambon, all great actors, Patrick Stewart, and they're all up for the same role. They're all great actors. And one will get the part by virtue of how well that person interacts that's been cast as the female or the bad guy. So it's about chemistry. But to understand that intellectually is one thing. To experience it emotionally, when they say, sorry, you didn't get the part, you know, you're upset, you get disappointed, you know, but you have to allow that emotion to happen, then move on.
My mother was an actress, and she, her agent once called her and said, I've been called about a Fran Lope type. And her agent said, well, I'll send you Fran Lope herself. She showed up, and there were four other women who looked exactly like her, and
no.
She didn't get the part.
Oh, that's what great, what
no,
cruel,
that wasn't so,
cruel
she wasn't
irony.
Too happy about that.
No, I wouldn't necessarily, I would think
so,
not.
But they don't do screen tests anymore, do they?
Well, they do from time to time, yeah. I tested for Oliver Stone's W. I did a screen test for W before I was cast in that role as Earl Hood. They do. And I'm constantly auditioning for voiceover work, you know, for commercials, because people want to hear your voice against a product. I mean, it's not that you don't, you know, that you're not. The difficult thing for young actors is not to take it so seriously that they think it's about them. It's about their lack of talent. And that's what I try to teach when I'm teaching my kids.
You teach?
I do. I teach at George Mason University. And not this year, but last year I taught there. And I taught via Skype. I taught acting via the wonderful technology that we have today.
Well, when you were at Yale, you organized your own acting class.
I did.
I'm sure some of your professors weren't too happy
no,
about that.
No, they weren't. Yes, but I had, as my students, Henry Winkler and James Naughton were two of my brother, James Keach. It was a great experience.
Did you become politicized while you were at Berkeley? There was the time when Berkeley was a hotbed of radicalism.
I did. I was very much against the war in Vietnam, yeah. I became very politically active in that respect, yeah.
And then you appeared as Lyndon Johnson in Barbara Garson's McBird.
Right.
Was that your big breakthrough?
That was it. That was the beginning of my career, really, in a sense, even though I'd started with Joe Papp in the New York Shakespeare Festival playing small parts in a couple of plays. But that was really the role that brought people, brought my attention, that's what did it.
Well, it gave you the opportunity to play LBJ and Macbeth at the same time.
Exactly. Now you have to spit three times and turn around. You've said that word in a studio. I'm doing it.
No, it's okay. This is not a theater. It's okay.
Well, you know, I've been told it doesn't matter where you are. If you're in the business of entertainment or performing, as you are, and I am, you can't say that word.
Well, I've said it many times.
And you're still
maybe
here.
That's the reason that I'm still in public radio.
Okay, good.
You write that Barbara Garson was among the first to give full voice to the conspiracy concept surrounding the JFK assassination. Of course, we're going to be talking a lot about that
years.
Again because of the anniversary of it.
Right.
People discuss their theories pretty openly today, but at the time of McBird, wasn't that a problem?
It was considered seditious if you even suggested that Lyndon Johnson was responsible for the assassination of John F. Kennedy or had anything to do with it. Interestingly enough, I just did a BBC broadcast radio show called Air Force One, and it's a radio drama for the BBC about the swearing in of Lyndon Johnson. I get to revisit Lyndon Johnson as I played it on Air Force One from the time of the assassination to the time that they got to Edwards Air Force Base. Yeah.
Because he was sworn in as president at that time.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. You won an Obie and a Drama Desk Award for that role, but were you concerned that that was going to hurt you in some way?
No, I wasn't. I was concerned that people were only going to think of me as Lyndon Johnson, and I got asked to do every single recording, you know, and use his voice and show up at rallies as McBird, and that I didn't like because I wanted, you know, I wanted to be regarded as somebody who could do other things, just not just Lyndon Johnson.
Well, maybe also presidents. You also played Richard Nixon.
Right, that's true. Well, that was some years later, of course. Yeah.
In the late 60s, you started dating Judy Collins, who had just ended her relationship with Stephen Stills.
Right.
Was it painful to hear Judy Blue Eyes?
Because
it was played everywhere?
Everywhere. Every time we turned on the radio, you know, and yes. No, it was not a great experience. Yeah, but in retrospect, Stephen and I became very good friends some years later, and Judy and I are still very good friends, and I'm still inspired by her wonderful music. Yeah.
You also mentioned briefly in the book that you went to Woodstock.
We did, yeah, and I got to meet Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin. It was an experience. It was an amazing time.
Well, you say you had tea with Jimi Hendrix. Is tea a euphemism?
No.
You really had tea?
No, it is a euphemism. Yeah.
But that must have been was that when you first started getting involved with drugs? Because that's also a major part of the story.
My drug involvement really started sometime later, a little bit later. It was just about the time of my camera. Yeah. And it was in the early 80s, actually, yeah. That began, you know, that happened. And I talk about it very openly in the book because I feel very strongly that I want people to know how lucky and fortunate I feel to be able to, 30 years later, sit down and write about it. But I went through some terrible, you know, tough times.
And not tough to attempt it at all anymore?
No, not at all. Now, going to jail for 6 months can cure you of those, you know, habits. And it did me, thank God. Not everybody gets cured, but I was very fortunate.
Stacy Keach has written a memoir called All in All, An Actor's Life on and Off the Stage. It is published by Lions Press, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we're back with Stacy Keach, who's written a memoir called All in All, An Actor's Life on and Off the Stage, published by Lions Press. Why that title?
Well, it's based on, there's a line from Shakespeare, take him for all in all, we shall not look upon his like again. Yeah. And all in all, I've had a wonderful life. I mean, it's kind of, you know, I just said that was a little bit long. I thought of other titles like On the Brink or Almost but Not Quite, and I thought, no, I think.
You could have had a pun on Hammer as well, because the importance of Mike Hammer in your life.
From Hamlet to Hammer or something right. Like that. Yeah.
Well, we opened the show with a visit from Angelica Houston, which reminds me that you starred in John Huston's classic film, Fat City.
Right.
If I remember correctly, the first 5 minutes were without dialogue, and that strikes me as a bold choice for a Hollywood film in the early 70s.
He was a bold director. He did things that were very adventurous. I mean, in Reflections in a Golden Eye, there's that one little splash of red. It was sort of in sepia. I mean, he was a great, great, great man, a great director, and had great, great insights. And he was a natural filmmaker.
Well, wasn't that a demanding role for you physically? You had to...
Yes.
Trained to look like a boxer.
I trained right here in New York City with Jose Torres.
Who had been the former light heavyweight champion.
That's correct, yeah.
In the book, you called that one of your finest achievements, even more than Shakespeare?
Well, I think in film, yes. In film, I think I really meant in film, yeah. And it was because I learned a skill. A lot of times as an actor, you learn how to do things that have absolutely no... you know, future value, like walking a tightrope or boxing, you know, even though as a boxer, years later, I did this series called Lights Out, which was on a few years ago, and I played a trainer. And because of my experience as a boxer in Fat City, I had done my research without, you know, just intuitively.
Despite the fact that John Huston was one of the greatest filmmakers of all time, didn't executives at Columbia cut about 20 minutes out of the film?
Yes, they did, and much to the chagrin of both John, myself, and others.
What did they cut out?
They cut out the fall, Billy Tully's fall. After he loses the fight, he comes back to his apartment, he's thrown out of his apartment, and he ends up. He ends up almost getting knifed in an alley, and he ends up sleeping in an incinerator. That was all cut out. Plus, Billy Tully's rise to fame when he was a champion. We shot a sequence where you saw him in his heyday when he was on top of the world. Those elements were cut. And
do you think it hurt the film?
I do, because I saw an original screening at Ray Stark's house. Ray Stark was our producer. I think Angelica may have been there, as a matter of fact, when it was in it was a 2-hour film, and it hit rock bottom as the book did, and I think that's what this film was really about. But Columbia executives were frightened.
Well, in those days, 2-hour films were not the norm, and now they are.
True.
But you also write about loving the idea of not being typecast. Do you think insisting on that has helped or hurt your career?
I think it's helped. In the long run, but in the short run, back in the day, it was not a good thing. It was something that, you know, people wanted to know who is this guy, and I kept saying I'm whoever I happen, you know, to be cast as. I mean,
you grew up, you said, near John Wayne. John Wayne, of course, made a living off of being the
John
same
Wayne.
Character for so many years, and then people remarked once in a while when he just. Diverted was a little different, and suddenly they said, well, the guy can really act.
I know. True Grit, the first True Grit, yeah.
So you also kept on going back and forth between films and television and stage. Is that to keep you on your toes or keep you engaged?
I love the different mediums. They each have their own values, and I love doing all of them. I love the theater, and I'm still doing it. I'm still going back and forth. I had a professor in college who once told me, he said, if you want to be an actor, you're going to be, it's like being a sailor. You're always going to be on the road or out at sea or, you know. And then we were talking about that. My wife was saying, it's true. My wife is Polish. And she said, there's a lot of truth in that. Yeah.
Early in your book, you call Hollywood a place where shallow people made selections based on superficial values.
Right.
Did that ever discourage you about being in the business?
No, because I grew up with it. I mean, it was something I got to learn because of my family at a very early age.
You watch your father being frustrated.
Yes, absolutely. I saw him, you know, being, you know, and again, watching him being rejected a number of times was very enlightening. I think I gained a perspective that carried me through my bad times when they happened. In later years.
Well, how bad a time was it when you were cast in Catch 22 and then dropped from the project almost as soon as you joined the production?
Devastating. It was one of the most devastating. And I was a young actor on the rise. And, of course, it was the movie of that year. And everybody.
And with Mike Nichols.
Mike Nichols, I mean. And Alan Arkin, who I'd done Heart is a Lonely Hunter with. And a wonderful, wonderful group of people.
Well, what happened?
Well, I was told that I was too young and didn't have an ear for the part. You know, and I was cast as Colonel Cathcart, and it's true, I was too young. But I had just played Falstaff in the Park, so I had created an impression of that I was a young actor who could play old guys. And they thought, okay, we'll give him a shot. Well, I guess the visual aspects didn't, you know, measure up. So Martin Balsam played the role.
How did you come to play Lieutenant Ben Logan in the series Caribe? That's another...
Caribe, with Carl Franklin as my partner. Quinn Martin show, yeah.
That's when you first grew the mustache?
Well, no. I had grown a mustache prior to that, but it was... I had done a motion picture called The New Centurions with George C. Scott. And there was a period in that where I had a mustache and Glenn Martin and his associate Tony Spinner thought, because the ratings were not good, that I should grow a mustache. Well, I didn't have time to grow a mustache. We're in the middle of production, so they said, wear this, you know, and this mustache. And we're shooting it out in the Everglades where it's steaming hot, so the mustache would kind of, every time I'd open my mouth, would start sliding off my lip. It was no fun at all. And I called Quinn and I said, Quinn, I just can't wear the mustache. And Tony Smith said, well, if they cancel the show, it's your fault.
Well, you'd been born with a cleft lip and a partly cleft palate.
Right.
I'm assuming that was a rough thing for you when you were a kid.
It was. I was teased as a kid, yeah. I was, yeah. But my parents... My parents were very supportive, and they wanted to instill a certain value in me that I would... And it was not... Even though I was different than other kids, that was a good thing, not a bad thing. And that I, you know, and I became sort of an overachiever, I think, as a result of that.
But I would assume that when your acting career was taking up, people were encouraging you to wear a mustache simply to mask the scar.
In some cases, yeah. And still, you know, that's true. And I still to this day, I mean, I ask, you know, whether you want me to cover it or, you know. I played Robert J. Oppenheimer in a television production right at the beginning of right after McBird. And Dick Smith, the great makeup man, made a prosthetic piece that covered my scar, which kept coming up on the edges because whenever I would sweat, it was a rubber, you know, piece. And I thought to myself, no, this is too much trouble to have to do this every single day, you know, for the rest of my life to hide from the fact that I have a scar.
So slipping mustaches and slipping prosthetic pieces.
Exactly.
My guest is Stacy Keach. His memoir, All in All, An Actor's Life on and Off the Stage. You talk about a prosthetic piece that Orson Welles had made for his nose, but it looked just like his regular nose.
It looked exactly like his nose.
Why would he want to have one?
I think it was like a security blanket. I think it was a crutch. I think, you know... And he this was a movie called Butterfly. He was playing a judge, and I played I played an incestuous father in this, and I was on trial for my sins, and Orson had cue cards for all of his lines. We thought he can't remember his
line. Later, Marlon Brando did the same thing.
Well, but Marlon Brando really couldn't remember his line. The thing about Orson Welles is when they turned the camera on, he knew the lines perfectly. But there was a crutch. It was a crutch, and I think the nose was the same thing. I think the nose...
He bitter about how his career had gone?
He never expressed those sentiments to me. I never, you know, and
Because talking about rejection.
Well, I think that he was. I mean, you know, in all the books and things that I've read about Orson, I've always been fixated by his career and his talent, his genius. He was bitter. And Norman Lloyd, who worked at the group in the Mercury Theater with him, is still alive, as a matter of fact. And somebody I worked with, he produced the Hollywood Television Theater when I directed six characters in Search of an Author and Arthur Miller's Incident at Vichy, told me that Orson was, in fact, very bitter.
You write that in the mid-70s, your career dried up as quickly as a puddle in the summer sun in Texas. I love that. But that when the world feels like a cold and lonely place, well, that's when we're ready for Samuel Beckett. Now, was this also the time when we got involved with drugs?
Yes, it was.
Are the two related, the fact that you were having career problems?
Yes, it was. You're absolutely right.
And then
right.
Cocaine was really available everywhere in the film world at that time.
Exactly, in the 80s, in the early 80s. I thought it was innocuous. I mean, I didn't know that I was going to soon find myself needing to go back to it.
Not addictive, but of course people need it a lot.
Yeah.
You say that one of the funniest lines of your career came in a film called Mountain of the Cannibal God. Mm. Can you say it on the air?
I don't know. If I can remember what
it's... Well, I can tell you what it
go
was.
Ahead.
You never forget the taste of human flesh.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah.
And they expect you to say that totally serious?
You know, that movie, we shot that movie in Sri Lanka and Kuala Lumpur and that part of the world, and there were these people eating snakes, raw snakes, and doing these terrible things to animals. And I wasn't happy with that.
And the film was banned in the UK until 2001.
Yeah. No, I think so. Absolutely. I mean, it was not talk about cruelty to animals. I was very unhappy about that.
We don't have much time, but Mike Hammer, you've said you'll always be Mike Hammer. I would have thought you'd always want to be some character from Shakespeare or the character in Other Desert Cities, some of your more famous roles.
Well, thank you very much. It's not that I want to always be Mike Hammer. It's that I feel like I will always be Mike Hammer in some respect, because I'm still Mike Hammer. And we're doing doing radio novels of Mike Hammer material even as we speak. And Max Allen Collins has written some wonderful posthumous books based on Mickey's notes, and has finished the books, and those books I read Mike Hammer.
You know. So did you try to base your interpretation on the books themselves?
Yes. And also extending beyond that to try and find a greater degree of humor. I've often said that Darren McGavin always been my favorite Mike Hammer, because he gave humor to that to the role. Ralph Meeker was the nastiest, meanest Mike Hammer in Kiss Me Deadly. I did too. I love that.
Just one more thing. We don't have much time, but you've said that you don't think American actors should play Shakespeare with a British accent.
No, I don't. I think you should use a mid-Atlantic accent. I think it has to be. Yeah, I don't think. But first of all, I don't think American actors should use unless they're playing a Brit. You know, I don't think that Shakespeare should be considered exclusive to Great Britain.
Well, if you do it in Russian, you're doing it in Russian. But also, we don't even know how English was spoken during Shakespeare.
No, we don't. Oh, no, we don't. There are a lot of theories that the A's were very flat.
Stacey Keach has won a Golden Globe, many Drama Desk Awards, Obies. There have been Tony and Emmy nominations, and he tells the whole story in his memoir, All in All, which is published by Lions Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for inviting me.